From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy.
The debate is whether tiny aerosols can remain in the air for hours and spread much farther than 6 feet.
Nobody is going to be safe until everybody is safe. So this is the approach to Cuba to tackle this pandemic.
We will continue to investigate the use of force employed by the NYPD during the protests.
Policing is broken because it's working exactly as it has been intended.
COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort from the Pacifica Network and our affiliates throughout the U.S. This edition is presented by Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York. I'm Linda Perry. In today's program, the controversy over how far COVID-19 droplets can actually spread. Racial profiling in full view by the New York Police Department during recent protests. The housing and eviction crisis exacerbated by COVID-19. And the Cuban ambassador to the UN says the U.S. is threatening countries which ask Cuba for help in fighting COVID-19. All this and more, but first the news.
In a highly anticipated decision, the Supreme Court ruled today, President Donald Trump cannot block a subpoena for his financial records sought by a New York prosecutor. The majority rejected the president's claims of absolute immunity from criminal investigative process. The decision is a major legal defeat for Trump, although it is highly unlikely the public will see the president's tax returns or financial records before Election Day, as the case now returns to a lower court. A second case over congressional demands for the president's financial records was also sent back to a lower court. The Supreme Court ruled today that nearly half of Oklahoma falls within an Indian reservation, a decision that could reshape the criminal justice system by preventing state authorities from prosecuting offenses there that involve Native Americans. The 5-4 decision, potentially one of the most consequential legal victories for First Nations people in decades, could have far-reaching implications for the 1.8 million people who live across what is now deemed Indian country by the High Court. The lands include much of Tulsa, Oklahoma's second biggest city. The case was steeped in the United States government's long history of brutal removals and brokered treaties with indigenous tribes, and grappled with whether lands of the Muscogee Creek Nation had remained a reservation after Oklahoma became a state. Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Westerner who has sided with tribes in previous cases and joined the court's more liberal members, said that Congress had granted the Creek a reservation and that the United States needed to abide by its promises. Coronavirus cases are soaring in Tulsa following Trump's indoor rally in the city on June 20th. On Monday, Tulsa County reported a record 261 new cases. Dr. Bruce Dart, the Tulsa Health Department director, linked the cases' rise to recent large events in Tulsa.
The past 2 days, we've had almost 500 cases, and we knew we had several large events a little over 2 weeks ago, which is about right. So I guess we just connect the dots.
Trump surrogate Herman Cain, who attended the rally, has tested positive for COVID-19. Trump is planning to hold another large campaign rally this weekend in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, but many top Republicans in the state do not plan to attend. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner has forced the Republican Texas Party to cancel its upcoming in-person state convention, citing health concerns. This morning in New York City, workers shut down the block of Fifth Avenue, Manhattan, where Trump Tower stands, to paint an enormous Black Lives Matter mural. New York City Mayor de Blasio joined the effort. The mural drew a particularly angry reaction from Trump after it was announced late last month. Trump has called it, quote, a symbol of hate that would be denigrating Fifth Avenue, known for high-priced apartment buildings and luxury shoppings. Newly released transcripts of body cam footage reveal an extended account of the moments leading up to George Floyd's murder. The transcripts from cameras worn by former officers Thomas Lane and Alexander King show that Floyd pleaded some 20 times that he couldn't breathe and that one of the officers expressed concern about Floyd's well-being, but was rebuffed by his superior. The transcripts were filed in Minnesota State Court on Wednesday as part of a motion to dismiss charges against Lane. I'm Askia Muhammad.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Are the thousands of young people who bravely protested against racism last month during the pandemic now coming down with the coronavirus? And over 200 scientists are now claiming the World Health Organization is vastly underestimating the distance that aerosols can spread the virus. So, who's right? This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics and host of Exploration. Every week, we discuss the cutting-edge issues affecting science and society. Now, there's a new embarrassing controversy swirling around the World Health Organization, as many scientists now claim that the WHO has, once again, vastly underestimated the true danger of the coronavirus. Now, it's hard to believe, but originally, the WHO said that masks were unnecessary. That's right. In fact, the WHO claimed that you should not wear masks because healthcare workers needed them instead. After a mountain of data has come in, the WHO finally did a 180-degree turn, and it now admits that, yes, masks do provide some valuable help. Then the WHO claimed that the virus was only spread mainly by people who already show symptoms of the disease. Asymptomatic spreaders were rare. But scientists now have piles of data showing that up to 50% of infected people can be asymptomatic, spreading the virus without their knowledge. Now, the latest scandal is that the WHO still claims that it's enough to be 6 feet away from others to prevent spreading the virus. But now, over 200 health professionals claim that the virus might be airborne on tiny aerosol particles that might spread the virus over 20 feet. Now, here's the nagging question. How can the 6 feet rule explain the problem of super spreaders? How one person might go on to infect perhaps 100 others? That defies the 6 feet rule. Super spreaders have not been documented in many countries, infecting entire bridge club games, church choirs, funerals, celebration, wedding parties, sporting events, far beyond the 6 feet rule of the WHO. At MIT, aerosols have been traced to spread up to 26 feet. Now, the WHO is correct in stating that most large droplets containing the virus fall to the ground within 6 feet. That is still correct. But the debate is whether tiny aerosols can remain in the air for hours and spread much farther than 6 feet. Now, here's an experiment that you can do in your own home. Take a bottle of perfume and spray your room with it. Notice that it rapidly fills up the entire room with tiny aerosols and lingers for quite a while. What this means is that eventually new guidelines may be required. For example, if you are outdoors, the 6 feet rule may still apply, since you are less likely to be infected if you are outdoors. But if you're indoors, the 6 feet rule may have to be totally changed. And speaking about outdoor events, perhaps you were one of the thousands of brave people last month who took to the streets to protest racism. The question is, how many demonstrators have gotten the virus? Now, it is difficult to answer this question because the recent surge has engulfed fully half of the entire country, including a mix of partygoers, Memorial Day celebrators, beachgoers, people suffering from cabin fever, as well as demonstrators. But epidemiologists have noticed that demonstrators have several things working in their favor. First, they were mainly young. Although the young can certainly get the virus, the immune system of the young is better equipped to handle the virus than for the elderly. Second, the demonstrators were outdoors. It is about 20 times less likely to get the virus if you are outdoors where the virus can be diluted. Third, many demonstrators wore masks. Fourth, most demonstrators were exposed to others for just a few minutes, not engaging in long conversations during a march. Now, the one factor working against them is that the virus is 10 times more plentiful if you are near someone who is chanting, singing, or shouting. But even then, most of the chanting was done in the forward direction, not aimed at other demonstrators at all. So the next time you might be in a demonstration, take a few simple precautions, such as being outdoors, wearing masks, avoid long conversations, or being directly in front of people who are chanting. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics for Pacifica National Radio.
And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Linda Perry, WBAI New York. COVID-19, which hits communities of color throughout the U.S. hardest, brought with it an eviction crisis, which further targets vulnerable populations. Here's WBAI's Mimi Rosenberg.
And there it is, the 16-foot rat known as Scabby in front of Brooklyn Housing Court. We're about to attend a rally where tenants throughout the city are saying, shut it down. No housing court openings. No to eviction. Cancel all rents. Let's join the rally in progress.
I would like to start off by first giving a land acknowledgement. We are here on occupied, unceded Lenape and Canarsie territory.
Yep.
We are on stolen land, and it's important to recognize Indigenous peoples' enduring relationship with the settler colonial state. As we continue our long-term struggle for housing justice and the decommodification of housing. Secondly, I want to thank you all for coming out to today's housing court action. We were here 2 weeks ago, and we're here again mobilizing with folks from all over Brooklyn because none of our demands have been met by the state. The state has sided with the rapacious landlords by passing a mortgage cancellation bill, a landlord bailout bill, and the Tenant Safe Harbor Act. These bills provide relief for homeowners and landlords, but nothing for the tenant.
That's right.
In addition to that, Cuomo has not extended the eviction moratorium and is allowing housing courts to reopen. This not only exacerbates the housing crisis, but continues to put people at risk of contracting COVID, as we are still in the midst of a global pandemic. It is truly inhumane how the state will put the people at risk for economic gain. Our immediate demands have been set out for Cuomo to see very clearly since the beginning of the pandemic. We asked for an eviction moratorium, the shutting down of housing courts, rent cancellation, a plan to permanently rehouse the homeless, among others. But because there hasn't been any actual relief for tenants by the state, this is an egregious act against the people. They extract our hard-earned money, which comes from our labor.
I hate
tenants, the working class, especially black. in April. And this is why we are demanding state intervention. But even more important than these immediate demands is the call for this cancel rent movement to transcend the present reality of the pandemic. This is also about abolition, because we cannot... because we cannot live in a safe world where cops who serve to protect property and white supremacy, or marshals who are called into our homes to evict us, are present. All these struggles are interconnected. I believe that we will be able to live in a society where we are all afforded goods and services according to our needs. And not according to some arbitrary percentage of our wages. I believe that we will win. Thank you.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg reporting from Pacifica at the site of the citywide tenant rallies, this one specifically in front of the Brooklyn Housing Court. Shut it down, cancel all rents, no evictions.
I'm Celeste Katz Marston. This is New York in Crisis, WBAI's coronavirus diary.
I am Nery Velasquez, and I'm a Puerto Rican member of Congress who was elected to the House of Representatives in 1993. I personally was stricken by the virus. I came down with excruciating pain and fever. Then the next morning, I called my doctor, and I told him that I couldn't smell and I didn't have any taste. My temperature was close to 100, and he said, I believe you have coronavirus. You need to isolate yourself. From that point on, I spent 14 days in isolation, dealing with the pain in my muscles, in my joints, in my skin. I couldn't touch my skin. It was excruciating. I resent, and I am very critical, that the administration had information that they didn't share with members of Congress, and that we didn't move fast enough, that we wasted 2 weeks, two precious weeks. The scientists are telling us that at least 30,000 people will have saved their lives if we have moved with expeditiously, and we didn't do that. One thing that was so notable about the protest in New York and maybe around the nation is seeing people of all ages and backgrounds risking their health during this pandemic because they wanted to speak out about racial injustice and police abuse. So this speaks to their passion, but I think it's also further evidence that we have reached an inflection point on these issues. This time, there truly is widespread outrage and a real demand for tangible reform. So I truly believe that this time is different. The whole nation watched in shock the killing of George Floyd in real time. That never happened before. I just cannot bring myself to watch that on television. It was just so, it really rocked the conscience of our nation. And I believe that people this time, at this moment, are resolved that we must demand transparency, accountability, and that we bring reform when it comes to police brutality.
Nydia Velasquez represents parts of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Queens in the United States Congress.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain. We all have sorrows, but if we are wise, we know that there's always tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on. It won't be long that I'm gonna need somebody to lean on. You just call on me, brother, and you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. Hey, we all need somebody to lean on. Good morning, evening, friends. It's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. Is that love's in need of love today?
Welcome back. You're listening to COVID Race and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Linda Perry, WBAI New York. The Office of New York State Attorney General Letitia James was tasked with conducting an investigation into violent clashes between the NYPD, the New York City Police Department, and protesters in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Echoing voices of communities of color throughout the nation, the New York AG says many New Yorkers have lost faith in the police department, that trust is essential and critical to effective policing. She delivered a preliminary report this week recommending several areas of police reform, and her findings show signs of an old problem, discriminatory policing. This through less felony charges for white protesters than for protesters of color. Here's New York AG James.
Between May 28th and June 7th, the period of the most intense protests, there were more than 2,000 protest-related arrests in New York City. Of those arrested during this time, 44% were white, 39% were black, and 13% were Latino. Further analysis indicates that of those arrested, 16% of black protesters were charged with a felony. 8% of Latino protesters were charged with a felony, and less than 4% of white or Asian protesters were charged with a felony. The vast majority of those charged with felonies occurred on May 31st. When there was widespread looting of businesses, and between June 2nd and June 6th, when an 8 p.m. curfew was put in place. The vast majority of arrests were made after 8 p.m., suggesting the curfew was a significant driver of those arrests. We will continue to investigate the use of force employed by the NYPD during the protests
the use of kettling, whereby offices surrounded protesters on all sides, and arrest-related practices that resulted in reported injuries in many cases. This was also described as a crowd control mechanism. We will also continue to scrutinize the reported mistreatment of the press, legal observers, elected officials, and essential workers. And when I say mistreatment, I mean that they were arrested. And finally, we will continue to investigate other reported practices that impair community trust, such as the lack of PPE, the use of racist hand gestures, and the covering of badge numbers and name tags. Upon the completion of the investigation, we will produce a final report with recommendations based on any findings. And while we will not prejudge where the investigation will take us, there are bigger themes that have emerged over the first 30 days of investigation that go beyond any one isolated incident. These issues are not new to New York.
The New York State Attorney General is proposing sweeping changes to boost oversight and increase transparency of the New York City Police Department. She wants to change the structure of the department by setting up a new commission. It would have oversight over the NYPD and would be able to hire and fire the police commissioner and approve the NYPD budget. And the AG wants to streamline what cops do. She says social issues are beyond the training and scope of the police. Maya Wiley is a civil rights activist and former chair of the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which the New York AG says needs more power and final disciplinary authority over police. Wiley spoke to Josh Fox this week. He's a new host of WBAI in New York weekdays. His show is called Staying Home with Josh Fox, Your Revolutionary Guide to the Green New Deal, which he says is tied to social justice issues.
There are the huge events which everyone who's lived in New York during those era remembers, right? Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell, and there was
Eleanor
one
Bumpers.
Instance. Eleanor Bumpers. Oh my God! Mm-hmm. We're talking about this. This week is the anniversary of Do the Right Thing, which Michael Stewart, and the sodomy that happened when one of these immigrants was raped with a plunger in the back of a precinct, I think it was the 74th.
Volpe, Officer Volpe, we will never forget that name. Yes.
And the CCRB being a reaction to that, overwhelmed with complaints. Where is the system now? You're tuned in to Staying Home with Josh Fox, your revolutionary guide to the Green New Deal and why we're not going back. My guest is American civil rights activist Maya Wiley. We're talking about police brutality and the Civilian Complaint Review Board. This is a part of New York City's civilian or civic mechanism to complain about the police. We're seeing police department brutality rampant in the streets of New York City right now under a progressive mayor, not Mayor Giuliani, not Mayor Bloomberg, Mayor de Blasio. Where's the system now, and how can it function better, in your opinion?
You know, the good news is that we have increased the powers of civilian oversight, even just in very recently, in adding a critical component to some powers we already had, which is we already had the power to prosecute cases against officers in the administrative proceedings. These are employment decisions, not criminal decisions. But it, like in Eric Garner, it was our prosecution team that prosecuted the case against Officer Pantaleo. That's extremely important because it's a rare power in civilian oversight. Not a lot of cities have that power. But the second one we just won is also important. It's that now we can bring the charge of lying. So sometimes what happens in a case, you don't have enough evidence to decide whether or not the police officer did right or wrong, right? I mean, sometimes you can't resolve it because you do need evidence. It is a neutral body. And, you know, due process does matter. But sometimes you have enough evidence that they're lying. So the ability to say, okay, we don't know what happened here, but we can show that what you're saying cannot possibly be the truth. And that is so important. We had One of our reform district attorneys, who is also, you know, actively looking at reforming criminal justice by being a justice-focused prosecutor, said, I'm going to now make public police that we think don't tell the truth, which is incredibly important for defense attorneys to know. You know, one of the big shifts we've had in this country, thanks to the demonstrations that have been happening all over the country and in New York as well, is a recognition that, you know, maybe we put so much trust in police that we have overlooked when they actually are doing wrong and then telling us we should believe them that they're doing right. And civilian oversight has been important in that. At the same time, is that enough? No. And I think demonstrators are making that very clear, that we need to transform how we even think about public safety and what public safety is.
Well, I would like to invite all of the white activists who might be watching this program to spend some time in the New York City jail and go through the system and then come out of it and say, what did you see there? Because I have done this many times in my activist life and my activist career. And every person in the jail or every person who's trying to get their desk appearance ticket cleared is a person of color. And that is extraordinarily clear. So talk about what is the systemic racism that is a part of New York City policing that's and how to address that at this moment. It's a perpetual crisis, but obviously this is a moment of crisis that we could see some progress. What do you want to see?
Yeah, this is such a great question. So policing is broken because it's working exactly as it has been intended. And I think that's exactly what we have to understand here. It is a militarized containment and control model. And that's what it's based on. And so what we've done is essentially said, we're going to take investment and opportunities and not place them in communities of color that are already racially segregated and isolated, that already don't have enough public transportation because we prioritize roads over public transit, that already have, you know, crumbling housing conditions and overcrowded schools. And instead of putting our resources into those kinds of needs, we are going to say that the importance of containing and controlling crime is going to divert our public resources into expanding policing, which is a control and containment model. When you have a control and containment model, what do? You patrol, you see a kid, you think, I don't think you should be standing on the street corner. I'm going to throw you up against the wall and I'm going to frisk you now and see if you have a weapon or something else. That is the kind of constant harassment is the only word. You know, that young people in particular, and we have the numbers, young people in particular experience constantly in communities of color. And, you know, and in some instances creates dropout rates. You know, I've had stories of kids who drop out of school because they're so traumatized by their treatment on the street. And then when they see police in the school, they say, I'm not coming here anymore.
Maya Wiley in conversation with Josh Fox, host of Staying Home with Josh Fox, your revolutionary guide to the Green New Deal and why we're not going back.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
According to Johns Hopkins University, the number of confirmed cases of the coronavirus in the U.S. has hit 3 million. U.S. health officials, however, say the real number is probably closer to 10 times higher, close to 10%. Of the population. A concern as the virus spreads is whether it can mutate, Dr. Kamal Kamai spoke with Imhotep Gary Bird.
Let me say this, brother. You know, you sent me a copy of essentially what was at that time an unpublished report that was talking about the new mutations that were already happening with COVID-19. And certainly most of the public doesn't realize this. I think they tracked in that particular study that you gave me access to some 10 or 11 mutations. Now we're seeing it breaking in the mainstream news about this, what they're calling a new, more infectious strain of COVID-19. Can you talk about what this means in terms of brothers and sisters and the issue of continued vigilance?
Right. So for one, just keep in mind that this is what's called an RNA virus, which is different from a DNA virus, which tends to be more stable, like measles or something like that. But an RNA virus is basically this genetic material, and its protein coat, and it's more subject to mutations, right? And I think there are about, at least in June, I've seen evidence to say that there are about 14 different strains. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about a mutation, we're talking about some kind of change within the sequence of what are called nucleotides, which help to form the virus. And a lot of these are just minor changes, and minor changes may not cause any problem. But in that article I had sent you, it showed that the changes that are actually capable can actually change the whole pathology and what kind of disease picture that you actually see. So that particular piece stands in contradistinction to what a lot of mainstream virologists are saying, is that this virus is mutating very slowly, and they feel that these particular mutations, like this one that's mentioned in terms of increased infectivity, but increased infectivity doesn't mean that it's more deadly. So I would bring that up. In fact, even though we'll probably see the death rate rise, we see the level of infectivity rise, but it's not quite the same as before when COVID first came on the scene. So we can expect that the viruses will mutate, but according to mainstream medicine, they don't feel that this is going to affect their ability to make some kind of vaccine that will actually be able to target the virus. But viruses naturally mutate, and, you know, as I mentioned before, the virus has its own desire to live, and it's just figuring out how to connect with the human body. Most viruses want the host to live, because if the host lives, the virus also is there, right?
Mm. And goodness.
So we need to know that, you know, that ultimately the virus wants to live. So the virus is just working its way through the human population. So what you'll find is that some people, when they get the virus, because of whatever factors, and some of those have been identified, but for whatever factors, the virus just roars right through them and creates serious problems. For other people, it's barely a blip on their, you know, immune screen, and it doesn't really even register. But we can expect, especially, I mean, everyone knows now just from media that the United States is like, this has been a horror show relative to how this country is actually handled, the appearance of the virus and the public health measures. And I think it's just, it's really just taking hold that I think it's pretty clear that wearing a mask in terms of the aerosolized droplets, that's the main way that people are getting this, and less through surfaces, right? So it's an unfolding story, and again, my thing has always been, I don't understand why the government does not make people aware of the fact that there are natural antivirals, particularly vitamin D3, right, that really can help minimize you being, you know, at the back of the pack and the virus is just taking you out. I mean, that information is all in the medical literature, and particularly in African American populations of people that are pigmented, vitamin D3 is not really made because of the way the pigment affects sunlight and the production of vitamin D3.
Dr. Kamal Kamai speaking with Imhotep Gary Bird. You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network. We'll be right back. And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Linda Perry, WBAI New York. On one of our programs at BAI, Voices of Resistance, Lucy Paguada and Andrea Viseo spoke with Cuba's UN Ambassador Rodriguez about Cuba's contribution in the fight to battle COVID-19. Here's Lucy.
We want you to talk to us about Cuba's White Coat Brigade and its contribution to the fight against COVID-19 in the world. How does Cuba manages to do so much for the world and for humanity despite the blockade? And we know there's a campaign going on for Cuban doctors to get a Nobel Peace Prize. What do you think about that?
Well, Lucy, let me tell you, when COVID-19 appeared, we made since the beginning very clear our position on this pandemic. And it was saying out loud by our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, our president. And we said that to battle this pandemic, we have to put aside ideologies. We have to put aside a political difference. We have to encourage solidarity and cooperation among all the countries, because nobody is going to be safe until everybody is safe. So this is the approach to Cuba to tackle this pandemic. And following our principal position of cooperation and solidarity, we decided to help with the little resource that we have other countries that request our services. That's the reason why we dispatch Cuban Medical Brigade, 38 Cuban Medical Brigade to 31 countries. And you know, in the cooperation on the pandemic, COVID-19, there is a peculiar thing different that the cooperation that we have in the past. And now that we send now Cuban Medical Brigade to two developed countries. I would like to say we at UN talk too much about South-South cooperation and North-South cooperation, but we, I think, start to having a South-North cooperation. We send also doctors to Italy, and we send doctors to Andorra, but also we send doctors to 31 countries, all those who are requested, and we are in position to provide it. We send our doctor and to 31 country from different region, from Europe to Middle East to Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and this is without. This is also taking into account the situation in the country, because some people could think, well, maybe they are sending doctors away, but they are not looking properly the situation in Cuba. But the situation in Cuba is evolving very favorably. We always have navigated, let me say, in the more positive way of the curve. Just today, the information was... for midnight yesterday, we only have three new cases in Cuba, and we are in hospital. We have only in hospital 134 patients. We all the province in Cuba except Havana is the capital, and we know that this is going to be the last province to open. And Matanzas are now in phase two. We open all the province after we have. More than 14 days without any case on this province. And also let me tell you that on those countries that we cannot help with a medical brigade, we are having, and this is also another way to cooperate, we are having exchange with the medical authorities. We have exchange of our views on how we are handling. We are transmitting to them our own experience on how we are handling this pandemic that for us tracing the best combination because we can cut the chain of transmission of the disease. So other way of also cooperate is to exchange view on how we are handling this pandemic, what are the treatment that we are using. And this is also is something that other countries have very happy with the support that we are giving to them. Regarding the brigade, of course, we are so happy that I think it's a movement all around the world that are asking for the brigade to receive the Nobel Prize of Peace. I think that the Henry Reef Brigade already received a prize in 2017 of the World Health Organization. And let me, just as a mode of anecdote, this brigade that the name is Henry Reef, let me explain why we have put the name. Henry Reef, the brigade is a brigade that is specialized in disaster situation and serious epidemic. This brigade has experience, was the same brigade that went to Africa to combat the Ebola, but also went to Pakistan and some countries in Latin America. And Henry Reef was an American soldier from Brooklyn who served in the Cuban Liberation Army for 7 years. He participated in more than 400 combat against the Spanish army, in the so-called 10-year war from 1868 to 1878. He died in Cuba, and he died with only 26 years old. But in Cuba, he made a mark in Cuba, And I remember when Hurricane Katrina hit U.S. and the Cuban government decided to offer to the U.S. government our assistance to the people who have been suffered from the Hurricane Katrina. Comandante en jefe Fidel Castro named this brigade Henry Reef Brigade in order to this effort that helped to the Cuban liberation.
Ambassador Rodriguez spoke with WBAI hosts of Voices of Resistance, Lucy Paguada and Andrea Viseo. More than 2,500 people have signed a petition to give the Nobel Peace Prize to the Cuba Medical Brigade. For more information, you can go to cubanobel.org. And you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy over the Pacifica Radio Network.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, Pacifica Radio, WBAI, New York.
I want to end now with the speech that was given in Philadelphia at a demonstration this Saturday, demanding the release of a political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, former Black Panther, imprisoned radio journalist. This is a prisoner for recently released, speaking in Philadelphia. His name is Kempis Ghani Songster.
We are here to fulfill our mission, our generational mission. We have a planet to save. We have a future generation to leave a better world for. And our champions of human rights justice, some of the greatest champions of human rights justice, human rights, are withering away in prison right now. They are our champions. They are our champions. We don't fear them. Don't let the system give us their fear. They fear them. But we want them home. We feel safer with them home. We feel better with them home. They deserve to be home. They didn't rob nobody, they didn't rape nobody, they didn't sell nobody no drugs. And I'm telling you this, and I'm talking to you as a person that did wrong. I did wrong. I did wrong. I did 30 years and 3 months in prison from the age of 15 to 45, from 1987 to 2017. And it was those individuals, Russell Maroon Schultz, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who turned me from a pariah of my community and an enemy of my community into somebody that come out here to serve my community. They didn't breed terrorists. Let's not let them die in that prison cell without dignity. That's not how we do our champions. They made the ultimate sacrifice for us.
Can we turn that down?
Remembering struggle, continuing struggle, and understanding that, like our ancestor Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand.
Yeah.
Gotta make the demand. I just called to let you know I love you all.
We love you!
And I feel it. I feel it. I thank you all. I think of you all. And I will be with you all.
Let's go, Frank!
Doing what I'm doing.
Right on, right on.
True. And we will meet
in the whirlwind.
Yeah.
Right on! Right on! Let's go!
This is a special time. A time like someone my age hasn't seen in many years. But it's a time that's finally here.
Yes, sir.
And that means it's the right time.
Yeah. So, thanks.
Keep on revolution. Keep on resisting. Keep on moving. Stay on the move. I love you all. On the move.
That was Kempis Ghani Songster, an organizer with the Amistad Law Project, followed by the legendary Mumia Abu-Jamal, both speaking at a rally in Philadelphia last Saturday. I'm Johanna Fernandez, Pacifica Radio, WBAI, New York.
You've been listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, this edition presented by Pacifica's New York station, WBAI, New York. You heard Asghiya Muhammad, Dr. Michio Kaku, Celeste Katz-Marston, and Congressional Representative Nydia Velasquez, New York Attorney General Letitia James, Mimi Rosenberg with Jenny of the Crown Heights Tenants Union, Josh Fox and Maya Wiley, Imhotep Gary Bird and Dr. Kamal Kamai, Lucy Paguada and Andrea Viseo with Cuba's UN Ambassador Rodriguez, and you heard Johanna Fernandez with Campesconi songster and Mumia Abu-Jamal. This program was produced and hosted by Linda Perry, WBAI New York. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy.